and welcome to episode 35 for May 29th, 2007. I'm not even going to say it's a great show because this one is just so obviously great. There's no reason to... Wait a minute, I just mentioned... Dang it. Okay, next time I won't, for sure. Anyway, what we'll be talking about today is the studio system in an industry trend segment. We'll look at that weird kind of system which existed from the 1920s up until about the 50s or 60s. We'll have a trivia question from Sam. We'll get started talking about Disney features in the first part of a series spotlight. Sam's going to do all about the Disney animated movies. Our top six list is going to be all about movies we've watched over and over again. And I'll close out the show with another cinematographic term in our Film Buffs Dictionary. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard. And I'm going to take the first part of the show off, so I'm just going to let you, because while you're talking about the studio system, I think I really, really want to listen to episode 5 again. That was the spooky one, a Halloween special. I like that one. I've listened to that many times.
Sounds good. Well, I'll see you in just a moment without Sam as we talk about the studio system.
We talk a lot about this thing called the studio system, but I think a lot of times it's a term that gets thrown around without really being that well defined. So today's industry trend is going to spotlight the studio system, exactly what it was and what it did and why it's so important. So to give you a bit of background about it, it essentially refers to a period of time in American film from about 1927 through roughly the late 40s, early 50s. Most people sort of pinpoint its death at about 1948. And it essentially refers to the method of control that the big Hollywood studios used over American film. And because during this period of time, American film was so dominant in the world, it sort of becomes almost a shorthand for referring to films, period, made during this point in time. But it's going to be specifically American film. And we have just a couple of studios who are going to control every single aspect of production, of making movies, to distributing them, to actually even showing them. The studios are also going to control the theaters, and they're going to control the actors as well. It's almost like the way professional sports were set up for a long time, where athletes contracted to a team or a studio, unable to go where they'd like, and even traded around. And you know, you think of professional sports, you know, Major League Baseball or the National Football League or whatever completely controls that entire sport. They own the stadiums, they own the teams, they, for a long time, pretty much owned the players. Same kind of thing with the studio system. And we say it usually begins around 1927 because it's really going to be with the advent of sound that the studio system is able to be completely locked up. But it has some roots earlier than that. From very, very early on, there was an attempt to really control movies. In the early 20th century, say the early 1900s, Edison, who sort of was one of the early film pioneers, created a trust that would really attempt to hold all these patents on film technology, especially projection and recording. And of course, if you can't build your own camera because there's patent violations, well, you can't very well make movies. And this is what the trust was essentially trying to do. And interesting bit of history, one of the reasons that Los Angeles and Hollywood especially would become sort of the film capital of the world, because a lot of the early studio heads fled New York and back east, which is where Edison's trust was based out of, because it was simply harder for the trust to crack down on these patent violations if they were on the other side of the country. So a lot of the guys who sort of founded the early studios did it in part to escape Edison and his sort of thugs and also the legal system. But eventually a lot of that trust can be broken up and those patents are going to be disallowed, essentially. And so we're going to get, during, say, the 1910s and early 20s, just a flood of different companies making movies. Now, at this time, of course, movies are extremely popular, and silent films are not quite as expensive to make as sound films. So you can kind of get into the business with less money, and this is going to become a real key thing about film going forward, is that the cost is going to continue to go up. So it's going to be harder and harder to get into the industry. In the early days of film, a lot of these studios were started by immigrants, by people who had a little bit of money, but not much. And because this is sort of, early days of film, it was sort of a sleazy industry. It wasn't at all very respectable. It was kind of entertainment and attracted a lot of people looking to make some quick money because it was a sort of thing that you could shoot. You could shoot a couple silents real cheap and then show them all over the place. And, you know, sort of a different mentality in the early days where you would, you know, maybe pitch your thing to theater owners yourself. And on the website, in the vintage post, Sam has posted a lot of the crazy things that studios used to try and convince theaters to do to try and show their movies. movies. It was a lot more rinky-dink kind of thing, a lot more localized. We didn't have these big national theater chains the way that we do now, you know, where movies open on 3,000 screens at once. Here, back in this period of time, it was sort of movies opened up maybe around here, and they traveled around, and a much different system of distribution. But from about 1927 is when sound really catches on, as we've mentioned before. And within just a few years, really, sound is the thing. Every movie is going to be made in sound. And with sound is going to come an increase in production costs. So it's going to get much more expensive to make film because you have to have sound recording equipment, you've got to mix sound, all this other stuff. Essentially, it becomes exponentially more difficult to make a movie. And any time that you increase what we call the barriers to entry, you know, how difficult it is to join an industry, you're going to tend to decrease the number of companies who are in that industry. It's hard to break into it, hard to start competition. And so there's another thing that happens right around this time, which is the five big studios. These are going to be MGM, RKO, Warner Brothers, Paramount, and Fox, all essentially start buying up theaters, and they create their own theater chains. And they also build what are called distribution companies. There's three basic parts to the film business. There's production, which is actually writing movies, filming them, editing them, everything from starting with a script to getting the final movie into the can. That's production. There's also distribution. Distribution is the sort of logistics of getting made films out to theaters. And, you know, you don't tend to think about this a lot, but really, it's a lot of work. You have so many theaters across the country and across the world, even, and you've only got so many different prints of your movie. You've got to figure out a way to move it all around and try and get people to show it and try and promote it, that kind of thing. And there's also the third business, of course, is exhibition, showing movies. This is the actual theaters. And again, this is its own separate business. But these five studios are going to actually sort of control each of these aspects. It's something called vertical integration. It's a business term for when you own everything from production to the actual distribution. It would be like, for instance, if you know you were a hardware store that made all your own tools, shipped them to all your own stores, and then actually sold them. It's pretty rare these days, in part because it's mostly illegal a lot of times. This is sort of a business strategy that was really used in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Think of companies like Standard Oil or the way steel was organized, where really the sort of robber barons pioneered this whole idea of vertical integration, what we'd probably call monopoly, that kind of thing today, largely disallowed because it's so hard for competition to get into it. So these five studios are really just going to set this thing up, and they're going to be able to then exercise a lot of control because, you know, they can say, look, if you're some little independent theater, well, we won't let you show our big movies unless you also take our little movies, for instance. You know, if you show someone some independent studios films, you can't get our A-list movies. And so that's going to be a problem. So even independent theaters are going to be sort of harassed into complying with the demands of the big studios. And there are also three other smaller studios that are pretty important that don't actually have a whole vertical integration system. And those are going to be Columbia, Universal, and United Artists. So we sort of have the big five and then total of eight major American studios. And Columbia, Universal, and UA are not going to be nearly as important. They're going to be more kind of genre picture type things where certainly some great movies come out of them, but they're not going to be the same prestige that the big five have. And the reason this sort of system ends around 1948 is because that's when the United States Supreme Court decided that vertical integration was illegal, and they ordered the companies to break up, to sort of make the exhibition and distribution businesses separate companies. So you're not going to see that same level of control after 1948, and that's why a lot of people say 48 is the cutoff date for this. So let's talk a little bit about the way it worked. One of the big things that people tend to think of is the level of control over actors that the studios have. I mentioned that they were sort of like sports teams. Actors were contracted, loaned, traded, that kind of thing. If you wanted to make a movie with one of the big studios, so you wanted to, you know, make some money and you wanted to be a star, you had to sign these ridiculous contracts that were pretty much going to say you did what they told you. You were probably going to get just paid a flat salary. So it's not even, you're not negotiating per picture. These days, all the stars are independent, and they negotiate every single movie contract differently. Occasionally, you know, sometimes studios will sign stars to a couple of pictures. You know, today, you'll get a 3-picture deal or something. But for the most part, each movie is going to be today negotiated independently, so the actors decide how much they want to get paid, what kind of benefits, etc. But during the studio system, it's much more like a salaried job. They offered to pay you X number of dollars per week, you took it, and then you did whatever they told you to do, and you worked on movies as long as they wanted you to, and if they wanted to cast you in the same role over and over, they did, which is sort of one of the reasons that we have all these character actors during this time period, because it was really nice for studios to just typecast you, which not so great if you're an actor, but it's useful because it creates a real sort of shorthand for the studios. Like, we can put Humphrey Bogart as a gangster throughout the 1930s, and then every time we need a gangster, well, we'll just throw Bogart in there, and the audience already knows who he is. They've seen him before, they know he's a gangster, they know he's a bad guy. And so, of course, one of the things that actors have to do within this studio system to try and negotiate for better roles, try and lobby for, so that they can not be typecast, because, of course, everyone's ultimate goal is to become a big star.
And another thing that this sort of control had is that studios could gather all of their stars together if they wanted to and just make this one big mammoth star-studded production. MGM did this a number of times in some of their musicals, and Warner did it once for this movie called Thank Your Lucky Stars. And let me just list a bunch real quick. Humphrey Bogart, Eddie Cantor, Betty Davis, Olivia de Havilland, Errol Flynn, John Garfield, and on and on. I mean, the list is never ending, but those are a lot of names that you probably know. Certainly they were huge in their day, and they're all in this one movie because they were all under contract to Warner Brothers and they had to do it.
Right.
They wanted to make this big movie, and they all actually all play themselves, most of them. But so some strange things could happen after the studio system. It would be a lot more difficult to get that sort of cast together. There's a couple movies like It's a Mad, 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 Mad World does it and all that, but for the most part, it's just too expensive. But these actors under the studio system were on a weekly salary, whether they were working or not. So, hey, go do this movie and be a bit part in it, and because we want you to.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of fun in a way. I mean, it's a weird oxymoron. We think of the studio system as exerting really tight control over all the creative personnel, from directors to actors to the people, you know, working, building sets. Everyone's under the same kind of contracts. But in a sense, the movies made during this period are quite possibly the best ever made during American cinema. You know, the 40s are a real, and the 30s as well, just real great period for American film. So there's this weird thing where you'd expect that if we're going to hamper everyone's creativity and their freedom, that we're going to get poor sort of assembly line movies. But actually, in some ways, because there is this control, it's easy to get the elements in place if you need them. If you need to make Casablanca, you know, at Warner, well, you can go ahead and grab Bogart and Peter Lorre and all these other great actors to fill the sort of seams, and if you've got to negotiate to get a star from another studio or something, that's possible to do. But in a way, it's easier to put together all the elements for these types of movies. And lots of movies are going to be an absolute integral part of the studio system. It's much more of a factory line, an assembly line type of system. You know, this was established during sort of the height of the industrial era, and this was how you did things. You wanted to crank out as much product as you could, as cheap as you could. So there are going to be a lot of tight schedules, and actors and directors are going to be making tons and tons of movies. The studios released far more movies in the first half of the century than they did in the second half. Movies are going to be cheaper during this period, and there's going to be a lot of them. And, you know, part of this is going to be because people went out to the movies a lot more often, because, you know, it's less to do. There's no television, there's, I guess, radio, but that's hardly the same. There's not really mass media during this period of time. The movies and the radio are it, and they're not really at all the same experience. So if people want entertainment, I mean, how many times do you come home from work and just want to kind of veg out and from the TV? Well, if it was 1945, you can't veg out because there's no television, so you have to go to the movies. And so, of course, the demand for more and more pictures is much higher, which is one of the reasons that this sort of assembly line system emerges, because these companies have to fill this demand. Another thing that's really associated with the Hollywood studio system is the idea that each studio had a very strong image. For instance, MGM made lavish musicals. That was their big, strong image. And it was almost like a brand that MGM, you know, you saw, oh, okay, it was an MGM musical. We use that term because it has a specific meaning. Because the studio very, very deliberately wanted to focus on making this kind of thing. Universal did horror pictures. We know that. All those great old Universal horror movies, because they were able to sell them. And again, it makes sense, because if you're going to have these people under contract, well, you're going to kind of end up making the same sort of movies, because you have the same people to work with over and over.
over and over again. And hey, we can reuse the sets, we can reuse the same kind of talent to design the sets and to do the costumes. Let's go and keep all that, we can use it again and again and again. And so that's something that you really see, that we don't see at all nowadays. I don't think any of us pay attention really to what studio's releasing what movie, because this doesn't exist. There's no real strong branding of studios. I mean, occasionally with some of the sort of small studios that are owned by the bigger studios, you think of Dimension does horror movies for Miramax, Disney, that kind of thing. But other than that, you know, not a lot of strong branding anymore. It was something you absolutely had. And, of course, mentioned before, the controlled exhibition. The fact that theaters were really either owned or heavily pressured by the big studios. And this is going to really shut out competition in a lot of ways. You're not going to be able to see independent studios come around because they can't find anyone to show their movies. So, you know, part of this, too, that I forgot to mention actually during the assembly line idea, is the real birth of the B picture. Obviously, you only have so many stars for a studio, but since you're making so many movies, a lot of times you crank out, maybe, okay, you build some big sets for an A movie. Well, we can go and reuse that, and we can get some of our lesser-paid stars to be in that movie. And that's really where the sort of the B-movie comes from, this idea that studios, and maybe some of the smaller studios especially, would be able to just really crank out these B-pictures to meet this large demand. And like I mentioned at the opening, a lot of times you were going to have to take B-pictures if you wanted A-pictures if you were an independent theater owner, though really, I mean, obviously the trend is going to be towards studio-owned theaters. So what brought about the end of the studio system? Well, I mentioned the Supreme Court ruling in 1948 that made vertical integration illegal. So the studios had to sell off their theaters. Obviously, that's going to hurt them. But there's a little bit more to it as well. We can't talk about anything in this period of time, say the 1950s, without talking about the effect of television. And that's going to be one of the things that's going to hurt it, because the demand for movies is just going to decrease rapidly. And so the studios are going to have to move away from this sort of assembly line model, just make a lot of movies, to making fewer but more attractive movies. You're not really going to see the same demand for B pictures and just sort of talking dramas and that kind of stuff that you would during the 30s and the 40s. You're going to really see during this period of time more big spectacles, that kind of thing. And since those are going to, you know, take longer to make, they're going to cost more, you're not going to be able to use the exact same system to work on it. And another big thing that happened was that the stars started rebelling. One of the first big ones was Jimmy Stewart in 1945. Prior to his going off to fight World War II, he had been a star with MGM. He had a contract with them. But when he got back and started to get back into movies, he didn't go back to sign a contract with MGM, though he could have. He didn't choose to go with any of the studios. Instead, he opted to sign with a talent agency. And, of course, that's, you know, the norm today, is that stars have talent agents, and those agents are going to negotiate their contracts and find them deals, that kind of thing. Well, Jimmy Stewart, by doing this, could go make movies anywhere, and he got a lot more control over his image. And this is important to stars as well, because it allowed Jimmy Stewart, who was a recognized actor earlier in his career, to really become a huge movie star and to really pick his parts interestingly. You know, you think about Jimmy Stewart's great roles, say his role in Vertigo for Alfred Hitchcock, where he doesn't really play a particularly nice guy. That may not have been something the studio would have allowed him to do under the old system, because, you know, they wanted to maybe sell him as a more friendly, romantic lead kind of character. But Stewart was a guy who was obviously really wanting to have control over what he did, wanted to be able to negotiate his pay, and also his artistic choices. He didn't want to necessarily be stuck in the same rut over and over. And so once stars see this, that this is a viable method, they're going to start going toward it in droves. And so throughout the 50s, you're going to see a real move to actors having independent negotiations on a per-movie basis, or maybe per-few-movie basis, instead of this long-term contract system.
It's interesting that you mentioned Jimmy Stewart in the Alfred Hitchcock movie Vertigo, because there's a great counterexample to how the studio system worked in another Hitchcock film, Suspicion, made in 1941, starring Cary Grant. And the whole plot of Suspicion is that there's a woman who marries a guy, Cary Grant, and eventually, through a few different things, the clues here and there, and nothing that really ever seems to be conclusive of proof, but little indications that maybe her husband wants to kill her. Well, you know, if I tell you that this movie is made under the studio system, you sort of know what the ending really is. However, that's not what Hitchcock wanted. Hitchcock wanted a darker ending, and he just couldn't do it because Cary Grant couldn't be this guy that the studio didn't want his image to be tarnished in that way.
Right, and so obviously that's going to screw up some artistic choices, though. I mean, Suspicion's still a good movie.
Oh, it's great, yeah.
I think we'd all liked it with the original ending, though. It would have been more interesting. But yeah, I mean, definitely. And so along with these other forces, the Supreme Court ruling, the advent of television, the stars are going to have a lot more freedom. By the time of the 1960s, really, the studio system's pretty much dead. And we're going to just see really similar to the way film's organized today. And if you're trying to actually unravel the way studios work today, it's just ridiculously complicated, by the way. There's all these weird financing games, and studios are making multiple movies together, and there's all these little small production studios owned by big stars that collaborate with major studios, and there's all these pseudo-independents that are really owned by big studios. Anyway, it was much simpler back when there were only really 8 studios we had to care about, but an interesting period of time because it's going to really explain why movies were the way they were in a lot of ways in the 1940s and the 1930s.
This week's trivia question is about a popular 80s high school movie, and if you're faithful listeners of the show, you know that Steven just loves these movies, so hopefully he'll get this one right. The question is, what characters of a popular 80s high school movie began as an improvisational comedy act where these 3 different characters would comment on current events without actually knowing anything about what they were talking about? So think about that one, figure out what 80s high school movie might have had this type of origin, and we'll get back to the answer later on. Today, it's hard to understand the impact Snow White and the Seven Dwarves had in 1937. Basically, it started a movement in animation that is all around us today. I mean, everywhere. But in 1937, no one had ever seen anything like this. A feature-length animated movie for the whole family, it just never even occurred to them that you could do this. So this week, I want to talk a little bit about that and then try to sum up the long series of Disney animated features since. We talked about animation several weeks ago and kind of left this as a gap. So let's go in and fill that gap. Snow White, gosh, how many movies from the 1930s get seen as often as Snow White? Maybe The Wizard of Oz, but just that fact alone makes it significant. It wasn't quite the first animated feature. We did talk about others way back in episode 25, but none of them really demonstrated the potential of animation to create these characters that we care about and tell a story with some emotional impact to them. You know, similar to a story we might see in live action. So when Disney started working on Snow White, no one really thought it could be done. I think people were basically envisioning, if you can put yourself back at that time, the cartoons of the time were all mostly these 5 to 10 minute gag reels. And if you can imagine 90 straight minutes of pratfalls set to music, I think that's what people were basically imagining at the time. And so nobody thought Disney could do it. They thought he was a nut job for pouring all this money into it. It was very expensive to make. His own wife and brother didn't think he could pull it off. And so the project became known as Disney's Folly by the industry at large. Disney's Folly. Well, ultimately, the movie cost $1.5 million, but the end result is that, of course, he was right, and the movie opened to standing ovations. I mean, all those concerns just disappeared right off the bat, and it went on to become the highest-grossing movie of all time. Well, it only held that record for 1 year, exactly 1 year, in fact, and Gone with the Wind arrived on the scene. But that was, you know, also something unique.
Yeah. One interesting thing about that note, in terms of its success, is that, you know, if you adjust for inflation, Gone with the Wind is still the most successful film of all time. But there's a lot of argument that Snow White has probably been seen by more people because a lot of those tickets that were sold to it were children's tickets and matinee tickets and thus, you know, cost less. So unfortunately, they don't do a good job of keeping track of total number of admissions. But it seems pretty likely that Snow White has probably sold more tickets than any other film.
It might have. This was also the first movie to feature realistic animation of humans, partially accomplished with rotoscoping, as we discussed earlier, but not always. And there are a number of special effects techniques in here that were invented to animate things like rain and lightning. Anyway, Disney, of course, went on to do more, and the money was there. The next was Pinocchio, eventually released in 1940. I think this is my favorite of the classic Disney animated features, Pinocchio. It's a great story, very rich and colorful imagery and voices and everything. When you see this, notice
how many little details there are in the backgrounds and things. There's a lot of animated birds flying in the background. All this kind of detail. Snow White had it too. You don't see it so much later on. Even in the 40s and 50s, you don't really see that so much as the budgets got a little tighter. But it's a very lush movie. And among the characters in Pinocchio are Honest John and Gideon. And I have to mention this purely for personal reasons. These, I think, were the first bad guys that I remember striking a chord with me. You know, I mean, bad guys do that. Darth Vader does that. You know, Honest John. You know, I remember being intrigued at an early age that there were bad guys that were bad, but maybe not as bad as other villains in the movie. So this is the first time I was exposed to the idea that everything's not black and white. This Honest John character is definitely a bad guy, but he's not like the Coachman, which is just too awful to speak about, or the Wicked Witch in Snow White. So this made an impression on me as perhaps the earliest time when I started recognizing degrees of evil. So you got this kids' movie, but actually, you know, it's got some complexity to it and some stuff that children can think about. And, you know, these are not just the cardboard bad guys that are always just cackling all the time. Honest John was a guy that would lure you to play hooky from school, and my mother drove it into my head that, yes, these people exist. You know, as strangers talk to you, don't talk to them, because you just go to school. So, you know, these are real people to me. Also, we got Jiminy Cricket, I think probably the third most recognized Disney character behind Mickey Mouse and Tinkerbell. I don't know if that's exactly true, but certainly he's been a great, likable character for a long time. And in 1940, we also get Fantasia, totally different kind of thing now. We did mention this. It's born from the roots of the Silly Symphonies short cartoons, which are all about treating the music first and kind of animating images to go with it. And Fantasia did that in a number of different segments, all strung together with classical music. And then we get Dumbo and Bambi in 41-42, so we're picking up the pace a little bit. Dumbo, probably the weakest of these early ones, but great stuff in it, like the pink elephant dream sequence, which, you know, people would later interpret that as drug hallucinations and wonder about the subversiveness of the film and all that. I think it's more innocent than that. And Bambi, of course, very notorious in our just general cultural mindset now for the scene in which Bambi's mother is shot by hunters. You know, it's not even seen on the screen. That might be one of the reasons it's so effective. But at the time, these kids would be crying, and a lot of people would have to take their kids out of the theater because it was just too traumatizing. But it's just beautifully done. I mean, certainly it's very sad and maybe even scarred a lot of people, but it's a powerful scene, and it speaks to just what animation can do that people just never imagined 10 years earlier. But otherwise, except for that scene, you know, Bambi is a pretty joyful movie, and it's great characters that people like, and it's all about the cycle of life that would be revisited in The Lion King. So anyway, we got these first five animated movies really strong, push into some dark territory. It's not just for kids the way we would think of the soppy stuff we get on Saturday afternoon. The Wicked Witch, very scary stuff. Very interesting the way that animated features were approached at that time. But then what happens is World War II, and I think at this time the Disney studio kind of loses its way. Part of it is just the fact that a lot of the talent was either drafted or they were hired by the government to do propaganda films and things like that. So the commercial enterprise of producing animation is, we got more important things to handle at the time. World War II is a huge event. It goes without saying that it affected a lot of different things in a lot of different ways. But, you know, throughout the 40s, Disney is producing some films with animation, but there are these weird things. They're like travelogues, and I don't know. The next one is Saludos Amigos in 1943, and then the Three Caballeros, which is kind of a sequel, in 1944. Yeah, travelogues through Latin America, and they blend live-action footage of Latin American culture, dances and songs and so forth, and scenery with Donald Duck and these other guys, you know, guiding us from place to place and interacting. This is no real story. Strange stuff, and sometimes a real-life star like Carmen Miranda at the time would show up. It, like, in the 90s, the Japanese culture was the in thing. Just everybody wanted to be Japanese and study the Japanese culture and language and everything. Well, in the 1940s, it was the Latin America. That was what everybody was enthused about, and you can see that in a lot of Hollywood musicals as well. And then there are four more movies throughout the 40s that are these anthologies. Make Mine Music, packages up these separate stories and set them to music. Fun and Fancy Free, I don't know if you know that one, Bongo the Circus Bear, and maybe you know the second half of it, Mickey and the Beanstalk. They were packaged in a feature and released and hosted by Charlie McCarthy and Edgar Bergen. If you don't know who those are, boy, that'll take you back a ways. Melody Time, sort of a sequel to Fantasia, but with contemporary music. And then the one great one, I think, the Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad, which packaged together this adaptation of Wind in the Willows and another one of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. That's quite a good one. But in 1950, with the war over and everybody has had a chance to get back into the normal swing of life and the studio has rebuilt itself, got itself back on track, now we get these story-driven fairy tale films again. And we get four more right in a row. Cinderella, Alice in Wonderland, Peter Pan, and then Lady and the Tramp. And again, I think all four are really strong. They've stood the test of time. Obviously, people are still watching them. It's amazing. We're in the 50s now, but again, what other movies from the 50s do people watch as much of these? There are a few, but not that many. Beautiful animation, very soft animation. Disney was known for this soft, beautiful kind of style to it. Everybody else at the time was gradually moving toward more harsh tones, more contrast, more straight lines and everything. And then Disney actually does too, because we start to see Lady and the Tramp kind of moving in that direction. That was, by the way, the first ever CinemaScope widescreen animated film, and so we're also starting to play with the new technologies that have come about in the 50s. And the next one, Sleeping Beauty, was the first to be shot in 70mm. Very expensive to do that, but boy, you get all that detail in there.
That is actually interesting. I didn't realize that they were shooting cartoons in 70mm.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, it makes a lot of sense when you're doing a huge epic, when you want to see it on a giant screen, but man, now I really want to see a cartoon projected in 70mm on a big screen. That seems like it could be really fascinating to look at.
And, you know, if you're going to shoot in 70mm, that means that you would have to put all that detail in there for it to pick up, too.
Yeah.
Like if you blow up a Dilbert comic strip that you get in the newspaper to 70mm, it's not going to look any better, you know?
Right.
But yeah, and we also see the shift in the animation style, too. A lot harsher, I think. Sharper. Let me say sharper rather than harsher. And, you know, the lighting is more stark and dramatic and a lot more corners rather than curves. But it's still quite beautiful. You got the dark castle and the jungle of thorns and the dragon and everything. It's almost expressionistic in how it's dark, but it's also contrasted with these cozy little cottages and forest glades and things. And a lot of the reason that this movie looks a lot different from the ones before it was Disney gave over a lot of control to the production designer, a guy named Eivind Earle or something. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but he was given all kinds of artistic freedom. This movie took like 8 years to make, and he just wanted everything perfect, and the animators under him were just, it was not a popular decision to put him in charge. They were used to having more creative control over everything, but Disney said, no, this is the guy who's going to make this movie. So he did. Anyway, so the next movie kind of continues this stylistic evolution. It's not 70mm anymore, but we got 101 Dalmatians, which also has this sharp cutting feel to it. And as we mentioned before, we now have photocopying technology to do the inking onto the cells. But one of the early limitations of that is that the lines are going to be black and thick. So that definitely, we talked about this in episode 26 if you want to go back to that. But this is one of my favorites, 101 Dalmatians. I love the villains. I mean, you got Horace and Jasper, who are these great comic villains, and Cruella de Vil. I mean, I think she's without question the best Disney villain. She's got the insane eyes, the maniacal laugh, the humongous car, the endless trail of cigarette smoke. She's cunning. She's conniving. She's got that way of moving that makes her unpredictable. She could be violent in a moment's notice, or she could be oozing and ingratiating. I mean, no other Disney villain has this much going on, I don't think. But unfortunately, tightening budgets and a drop-off in the popularity of animation in general starts to hurt the quality of the studio's output. And it shows. You get, the next one is The Sword in the Stone, which is, you know, a good movie. It's a step down. The Jungle Book is next. That's also a step down. That, by the way, is the last one that Disney himself personally supervised. He died in 1966. The Jungle Book was released in 67. Disney was not that thrilled with it, actually, and he said something about, you know, I guess this animation thing, I'm just not getting it anymore. He had grown up against Peter Pan's better advice to him, I suppose. And then in the 70s, we get a real low, I think. I mean, The Aristocats, not very good. Robin Hood, yeah, it's fun, but it's not a classic. The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh, that is a good one. I'll get back to that one. Then we got The Rescuers and The Fox and the Hound in the early 80s. I don't know. It's just, I think what it was is the budgets were tightening up. This is also when the Looney Tunes kind of lost their traction as well, the early 60s. The artwork is kind of done cheaply. If you look at The Jungle Book, you know, a lot of the close-ups, you think that a jungle would be a wonderful place to put a lot of detail in the backgrounds and everything, and you see that in Tarzan way later, but in this one, the close-ups, you got these solid color backgrounds. It just looks cheap. And a lot of these different titles, there'd be chase scenes where they just go back and forth, so the characters really feel confined to a single dimension. You don't want animation to feel confined. This is, you do anything in animation, you got this wonderful sense of freedom, but you got to have the money to put into it to allow the artist to make a lot of cells. There's a lot of reused animation that kind of confines the action to these certain repeatable actions. So I don't know that any of them are really bombs, but it's just not that great, except, as I say, for Winnie the Pooh, which is a compilation of three previously released half-hour cartoons. I think they're wonderful. I mean, I can see how they're maybe too cute for some, but for the audiences they're intended for, I think they're pretty perfect. I mean, the great characters, just fun to hang out with. You know, I was kind of amused not recently now, I guess it was the late 90s or something, that suddenly Winnie the Pooh became all the rage again for no provocation that I could figure out. It's not like a new movie came out or a new book or something that made everybody interested in it again. I think everybody just decided all at once that they just had to have Tigger sweatshirts, and so that's what happened. Fortunately, though, you know, we've gone through two golden ages. We had the pre-World War II, and then they picked themselves up after, and then what happens is in the late 80s, they do it again and have a third golden age, but we'll talk about that next week. We got to save something. Well, we had a suggestion recently on the website, allmovietalk.com, to do a top six about movies we saw over and over again as a kid. And so we picked that, but then we decided to modify it a little bit because, hey, why limit it to when we were kids? Why not continue it on to the present day? Actually, for me, it's still going to be movies I saw as a kid because I kind of stopped watching movies over and over again, but Steven never did, so that'll probably be reflected in our top six choices. Well, this week, my number six is again going to be the Star Wars trilogy, and again, I hate to pick it just because it's kind of, you know, boring to pick it, but how can you not? I mean, I've seen these movies so many times, and like many, many, many other people, so many times that I can quote them virtually entirely without even seeing them. And I am, of course, just talking about episodes 4, 5, and 6. I have seen the prequels probably only once or twice each. But I don't think anybody my age who grew up in any semblance of a world of pop culture has not seen these many, many times and knows them all by heart. And, you know, even the people who somehow missed them, either because they lived in a cave or even the younger people who were born after these movies came out, they know the stories, at least, even if they haven't seen the movies. So it's just phenomenal to me to think about how strongly these movies have pervaded pop culture.
Yeah, the Star Wars trilogy is a great choice. Who hasn't seen that lots and lots of times? I know I certainly have. Though I didn't actually pick it for this list because there are movies I've watched significantly more than those films. My number six is actually a movie I was just watching last night again because it's a really good, fun movie to put on when you have people over. I had a bunch of people over playing board games. And we threw in The Big Lebowski from 1998 by the Coen brothers. It's just an endlessly quotable movie. Just so many great scenes, and it's great because it's sort of
strange, unfocused narrative makes it great to watch. You know, if you're doing something else, you don't have to see every scene for it to work. And just so much wonderful dialogue, the way it all kind of loops around and gets repeated over and over. It's just endlessly hilarious to me. And it seems like everyone I know loves this movie. It's sort of become a real cult hit, I think, since it was released.
Yeah, I've seen that movie once, and that was probably too many times. Oh, well. Can't agree on everything. My number five is another staple of growing up in the 1980s, and it is Back to the Future, made right in the middle of the 80s, 85, and I told the story here before, went to see it without really knowing anything about what it was, and came out absolutely loving it, and so did all of my family. Very broad appeal there, and lots of fun. They just get it right.
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really good pick. I'm surprised I didn't pick it, because I have this thing where at least once a year I go through and watch Back to the Future 1 and 2, one after the other, because they're so cool like that. Well, my number five is definitely a movie that proves I didn't start this list when I was just a kid, and because it's not a movie that children generally like a lot, but that I adore, and it's Casablanca from 1942 by Michael Curtiz. Just a wonderful film, and it's one of those movies that I put on if I want a movie that, you know, it was kind of comfortable and makes me feel good about myself. It's a movie that's really inspiring, and that's one of the things that I think makes it work so well for me. It's almost like comfort food. You just go back to it, and it's got such a wonderful script and so many great performances. Just great place to revisit over and over.
That's a great way to describe that movie, comfort food. I like that. Number four for me is going to be 1776, and I could have put any number of musicals. I've seen quite a few of them many times, My Fair Lady, Oliver. 1776, I've just, for whatever reason, had occasion to see it a lot of times, and I've discovered that each time it is as good, or in some cases even better. My family likes the movie too, so I saw it with all my different members of the family, and then when the DVD came out with the widescreen and extended edition and all that, so then I had to go watch it with each one of them all again. So I've seen it many times, love the movie. Steven, you're not a huge fan, but well.
I'm a little confused how you could watch it so many times. I mean, if you watch it, say, three times, wouldn't you still be on your third viewing? Because it's roughly 2 years long.
Roughly 2 years, yeah. It's not that long, come on. And, you know, like a lot of musicals, the songs improve, I think. A lot of the songs improve with familiarity.
Yeah, okay, maybe so. Well, my number four is another pretty easy geek pick. It's Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail from 1975. And this actually is a movie that I did watch a whole lot as a child. I had a mother who loved British humor, and especially Monty Python. So I was watching Monty Python Flying Circus and the movies by the time I was like, I don't know, six or seven, which probably explains why I'm so screwed up. But yeah, I mean, this movie, so endlessly quotable. And for a long time when I was saying like junior high or so, I had a real fun time introducing new people to this movie who hadn't seen it, and then just watching their reactions when the movie ended, because it has that really abrupt, out of nowhere ending. And I remember the first time I saw it just thinking it was terrible, but now I realize the whole joke is to watch it with people who haven't seen it and just watch their reactions. It's priceless.
I like that. Yeah, I hadn't seen A Holy Grail until quite late in the scheme of things. Kind of surprised that I missed it, but that's probably my favorite. Well, it is my favorite thing that Monty Python did. They're sort of up and down for me. Anyway, number three, going back to the 80s again, it's kind of betrayed when I grow up, doesn't it? It's The Princess Bride, and of course, tons of people have seen The Princess Bride again and again and again. It's another thing. A strange story here. I went to see it in college. Group of college kids all around. The theater was packed, for one thing. It was absolutely packed. The theater was on the campus. And people around me were mouthing the words to the dialogue throughout the whole thing. Not just key scenes, the whole thing. They would anticipate and mouth the words to the dialogue as it occurred on the screen for an hour and a half. Now, normally, that would drive me up the wall. This time, it still drove me at least halfway up, but, you know, that's part of the fun, is that this is a movie that, it's a cult movie. It's a big cult, though. A lot of people are into this movie to this degree, as with Star Wars and, you know, some other things like that. And it's just kind of neat to have that connection with people, the other people. You have this common ground. The Princess Bride, you can quote The Princess Bride. It's a strange phenomenon, because it's not something I'd ever watched the first time without knowing anything about its cultural impact and say, yeah, a whole generation is going to be captivated by this story. It's just, it's the most unintuitive thing ever, but but for whatever reason, it just hits the right kind of notes. It is a fairy tale, but it's also a meta fairy tale, and it straddles that bridge very nicely.
Yeah, you know, this is my number two pick, so we'll get that out of the way to start with, but this is a movie that I feel is really a cult film that doesn't get a lot of credit for really being a cult film. When people talk about cult movies, I don't think they often talk about this flick, even though it seems like everyone you know loves this movie, and it was never a big success, but yeah, who doesn't know all the dialogue? I mean, I can just randomly go around quoting this movie, and people will finish it for me. And this one's actually interesting for me because, Sam, you're the guy who turned me on to this. I remember seeing it as a kid in the 80s, and I don't remember thinking that much about it. I remembered it, I remember seeing it and liking it, and then you and our friend Dave really just turned me on to Princess Bride when I was, I don't know, like 17, 18 years old, something like that. I went out and I rented it, I watched it, and then immediately watched it again, just rewound the VHS tape and watched
it. So you had already seen the movie before that, and we kind of
as a kid
reintroduced it?
Yeah, I didn't really remember it very well. I kind of remember just having seen it and not really thinking that much about it when I was younger, and then I rewatched it again when I was like 17 or 18 and just loved it because you guys were raving how great it was, and I just didn't remember it being that great.
Huh.
But yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful movie.
Huh.
And just so quotable, so many great scenes you can watch over and over and over. Anyway, moving on. My number three pick is a movie I've picked lots before. It's my favorite film of the 1990s, and it's Pulp Fiction from 94. Just, you know, I noticed something with pretty much all the movies we've been picking is just really sharp dialogue, I think. I think that's a key component to watching something over and over and over. You know, great spectacle or cinematography, that kind of stuff. It's nice. The first time maybe makes a big impression on you, but on repeated viewings, what you really just notice is the dialogue and Tarantino's dialogue and Pulp Fiction, I think, is just fantastic. I could watch that scene with the entire scene at the beginning with John Travolta and Samuel Jackson as they're in the car and then up in the apartment just talking, and the way it goes and the rhythms. Just, I could watch that endlessly, I think, on a loop. I love Pulp Fiction, and I've watched it so many times. I think I have the whole thing memorized.
Well, speaking of great dialogue, and if you remember the top six actors for monologues, you know what I'm going to talk about here. Great dialogue. The Gods Must Be Crazy 1 and 2 would be my number two pick. you know, it's a strange thing. Steven, I remember we talked about this. You're not a huge fan. I don't really understand why people like it. And, you know, it's one of those things I can't explain why. I can't even explain why I like it, let alone why you might be able to enjoy it if you look at it in a particular way. It's just one of those things that is so unique. There's nothing, no other movie that strikes this type of tone to it. It's this hybrid between almost a documentary in some senses, some kind of strange terrorist thriller, almost, but not really, but mostly a comedy. And it's a comedy that includes slapstick, it includes the crazy dialogue, but more than that, it's the humor of just an outrageous situation. In the first movie, a Coke bottle is thrown out of a plane that's flying over the Kalahari Desert, and it lands where a tribe of Bushmen can find it, and they don't know what it is because they live just that isolated from modern civilization. They have no idea what glass is. So they're, you know, wondering what this Coke bottle is, and they decide that it's only brought them sadness because people are now jealous of the thing, and it's hurt people because they're hitting people with it. So a guy goes, and he's going to throw it off the end of the earth. And so he picks up the Coke bottle and journeys as far away as he can, and in the process runs across a lot of other people in the surrounding areas of Africa that's a little more civilized, but then you got all these other stories going on with, and then the second movie kind of picks it up where he loses his kids who find a truck parked in the desert, and it's a water tank hooked up to the back, and so they look in there and they see, wow, more water than we've ever seen in our lives, so they go in there to splash around and play and drink and whatever, and then the truck drives off, and so this same Bushman character goes chasing after his kids and again runs across modern civilization. And so that clash between living apart from civilization and then seeing civilization, being immersed in it, in a sense, this is still a third world nation here, but there's a lot of humor there, and it gives you a little perspective on what a modern life is like from somebody who doesn't live one. And love those movies, so I've seen them many times.
Yeah, and I just don't understand at all why. I grant that it is unique, but boy, not in a way that suits me. Anyway, my number two pick was The Princess Bride. We've already been over that, so I'll give it back to you.
Oh, I can't even take a drink of water. All right, well, my number one choice here, it's something that's actually, I'm kind of interested to talk about. It's The Great Race from 1965. I don't know that it's the movie I've seen the most, but it's kind of a special movie for me because it was one of the first movies I saw when I started really appreciating movies, and this would still be at a very, very young age, and it stuck with me till being an adult. So, you know, I probably haven't seen it as much as Star Wars, but I've seen it enough to know all the dialogue and all the jokes and everything and still enjoy it. And I really enjoy the performances. It's basically, here's the idea. Turn of the century, we're right in the middle of the women's lib movement, so there's some nods to that, but there's going to be a race. Motor cars are fairly new, and there's going to be a race from New York around the world to Paris. And that's the stage for one of these crazy adventures in the spirit of the old serials, or Dudley Do-Right, or any, you know, those kinds of things where the villain always wears black and the hero is always wears white and his teeth are always gleaming and never gets dirty. He can walk through a saloon. There's a scene in a saloon when they get out to the Old West where a fight breaks out and chairs and tables are flying around. And he's just wandering through the fight, not being ruffled at all. No, actually, I'm mixing that up. He did that in the middle of the pie fight, because, of course, a movie like this has to have a pie fight as well. So, yeah, just crazy. One comic set piece after another. It taps into all these different cliches. I think any mode of transportation you can imagine that would have been available to people at that time. Hot air balloons, trains, boats, they even float an iceberg across to Russia. It's just anything they can think of to use in a sort of comic adventure in the spirit of old serials, they do that. And the performances are fantastic. As I said, Jack Lemmon plays the villain, and he's, I think, most memorable. Peter Falk is his sidekick. Tony Curtis is the unruffled hero, and Natalie Wood plays the girl, because you have to have one of those characters. But it's a women's lib, the girl, so you kind of have that movement pushing against the cliches of the genre, the damsel in distress. And this was back in 65, before that became a pretty common thing to do. But yeah, again, I don't really understand entirely what the appeal is, but it is a very well put together comedy and great performances and writing and everything.
Well, okay, we have pretty different movies for our number ones, though my number one is legitimately a movie I did watch over and over as a kid. I can remember back in the 80s begging my parents to go out and rent a VCR, because there was a time when not everyone had a VCR, and they were actually fairly expensive. I'd go out and beg them to rent VCR so we could rent this movie. And that film is Ghostbusters from 1984. I don't know. I'm not sure precisely why I was so obsessed with this film as a kid, but gosh, this is a film that me and my brother would just watch over and over and over. We did that same thing where you'd watch it, then rewind it, and watch it again immediately in the same sitting. And when I watch it today, I still like it actually quite a bit. It holds up, I think, pretty well. I mean, it's a movie that was so part of the 80s, and it feels every bit the 80s movie still. But I know that Sam's not actually a big fan of this flick, but there's something just ridiculously fun about this. I mean, that was your plan, Ray. Get her. I love it. And I gotta say, I don't watch it quite as much as I used to, but it's one of those movies that I feel like I can just sit back, close my eyes, and play the entire thing straight through in my head anytime I need to.
Somebody blows his nose and you want to keep it. You're right, I don't love it. I don't dislike it particularly, but you know, one of the things is that I didn't see it at the time, in the middle of the 80s, right when it was coming out, right at that age. I saw it, well, not a whole lot of years later, but a bit after the curve. I don't know. I definitely don't dislike the movie, and it's certainly good to acknowledge that it did captivate 80s audiences in the same way that some of these others that we've picked this week have. Well, let's recap. My number six, the Star Wars trilogy. Number five, Back to the Future from 1985. Number four, 1776. Number three, The Princess Bride. Number two, The Gods Must Be Crazy 1 and 2. And number one, The Great Race from 1965, directed by Blake Edwards.
And my top six movies I've seen over and over. Number six, The Big Lebowski from 1998. Number five, Casablanca from 1942. Number four, Monty Python and the Quest for the Holy Grail, 1975. Number three, Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction from 1994. Number two, The Princess Bride as well from 87. And number one, Ghostbusters from 1984. So this week on Film Buffs Dictionary, we're going to keep talking about various cinematographic techniques. And, you know, you'd think that I'd learn to pronounce that word eventually. But I'm just that stubborn, I guess. But we'll be covering split screens, something that is pretty intuitively named. And it's essentially when you visibly divide the screen in half, either to do something kind of tricky or maybe to show two different things happening at once. And so the first real usage of split screens come about kind of from doing things a little tricky. There's this whole process you use to develop a split screen, at least before they had CGI that made things a lot easier, where you do what's called compositing. Let's say you want to... Okay, a famous example here is The Parent Trap. So you're going to have the same actor playing two different characters, and so you at first film her talking to nothing at all on the left, and then you do another take of her also, you know, talking to nothing at all, doing the other lines of the other character. So now you have two different shots, and now you're going to composite them together. So you essentially get a third negative, and you block off half of it so that it won't be exposed. And you go ahead and you print your shot on the left on that one, so now you have a negative that has half of it, something on it, and the other half has nothing on it. Then you cover the left half, and you expose the other half using that second shot you made. So now both the left and the right halves are combined onto one negative. Now, of course, this is kind of a strange process because where the two are joined, you will see a seam. And so when they used to do this for having, you know, actors play multiple characters, they would try and cover it up, and with various levels of success. You know, sometimes it's really obvious, sometimes it's pretty good. You know, you put like a door in the way or a wall line or something, so there's a nice straight vertical line you can use to splice them together. And, you know, in really low budget movies where they did this, it looks really terrible. But it's pretty much this thing that's going to be used for all that kind of tricky stuff, really up through the 1990s when you can really get digital technology to just sort of rubber stamp people into movies using, you know, the equivalent of Photoshop or whatever. You know, of course, now it's easy to do it. We all have digital photography editors that we've used before. We use Photoshop, so we know how to do it today. But, you know, for a long time, there was no simple method.
And they could do blue screen stuff, too.
Right.
Where there's this hilariously awful scene in, I don't know, one of the Critters movies where this one actor approaches a copy of himself, and they just kind of crouch down and stare at each other, and then they have this very conspicuously, hey, I'm showing off special effects shot where they circle each other in a 360 degree, and the only reason to do that in the story, I mean, there's no reason. The reason to do that is to show off, hey, we're not using split screen anymore.
Right, yeah. And well, the other thing, aside from doing tricky stuff with, you know, if you have bad special effects or whatever, is to show two things or angles at the same time. And this really came about in the late 60s. This became really fashionable. John Frankenheimer, in 1966, made a film called Grand Prix that used this with car racing and stuff. And kind of interesting. You can split the screen either vertically or horizontally, and you get this. You show two things happening at the same time. Or you can show one thing happening from two different angles, and it's a really weird effect, and I have to imagine it was even weirder in 1966 when you hadn't seen it probably before. I mean, another good example, very famously, the original Thomas Crown Affair from 1968 by Norman Jewison used this a lot to illustrate the heist stuff, and it just became really fashionable in the late 60s and the early 70s, you know, that whole period where American filmmakers were really experimenting with new cinematic techniques. They did a lot of this kind of stuff. Split screen became really the in thing to do. And especially Brian De Palma, who the director who really came about this time, he continues to make heavy use of split screens, but you know, really did it back in his earlier films.
An earlier use of this same idea, but a lot less arty, was, it's a cliche actually from the 50s and 60s, if you had two people on a phone,
oh, right,
you'd
yeah.
have them split in the middle, and so you could see each person on the phone with each other, and sometimes it'd be like a diagonal split, and now we get that parodied even, that same look today.
The thing about the split screen, though, is it's kind of gimmicky. It really takes your attention away from the story sometimes, if it's overdone. And I think really in the 70s, people just got sick of seeing it. It just looked kind of silly after a while, you know. And like you mentioned, it's easy to parody if you just show a normal thing, you know, like you show two people just walking around doing something, put a bunch of split screen, it looks overly dramatic. So it really fell out of fashion. But, I mean, it is an inventive way to show two things happening simultaneously, or to say, give us the perspective of two different people. You know, sometimes you get like two different close-ups on two different faces at the same time to show us how two people are both reacting to something. You know, there are some interesting ways, and it seems making a little bit of a renaissance. It was interesting. I was looking around for examples of split-screen films, and, you know, there's all these examples that pretty much end in, like, 1975, and then all of a sudden they start coming up again in the 1990s. Think of the show 24, you know, that huge hit TV show. There's, you know, about a billion split-screens in every episode of that show because it's all real-time, and so they'll show three different characters all at once on different screens, and, you know, that's a popular show, and that certainly is a kind of an inventive way to show the real-time stuff happening.
I like Run Lola Run.
Yeah.
I like that example because there's a race against time sort of thing where one character has to reach another, and so they put one camera on one guy and one on Lola, who is running. And what I like about that is eventually the two very different views from very different places, you know, well, she gets there eventually, and so now the camera is showing you a different perspective of the exact same scene, and so you can sort of see the same character in both shots, but
right.
From a different angle. That's very compelling use of it.
Yeah, there's actually a film like that called Time Code that I think I mentioned back when we did our top six extended shots.
Oh, yes, thing. That's right.
Time Code is another film where the entire movie is four split screens. They just, you know, basically split the screen up into four quadrants, and each quadrant contains a single extended take of the same story. So we sort of follow all these different characters all around, and the cameras regularly intersect with each other, though amazingly you don't see the cameras in the shots. I'm so impressed with how they did it. But, you know, and also like a guy like Quentin Tarantino uses the split screen a lot. I mean, obviously because in part he's paying homage to 70s films, but there's split screens in Kill Bill, and Jackie Brown uses it in some really great effects too later in the film. But yeah, so there's the split screen. Maybe making a comeback, maybe not. I think nowadays a lot of times it's used very consciously to echo 70s type movies, but also to a lot lesser extent, you know, you get shows like 24 that are just using it because it is an effective tool. So I kind of like split screens, and I hope, you know, maybe we'll see more of them in the future.
Earlier in the show, we talked about an improvisational comedy act with these three different characters commenting on current events. And this proved to be the beginnings, the origins, of what ultimately became a popular 80s high school movie. What movie do you think this was?
I gotta say, I don't really have any idea. I'm trying to think about this. Three characters. Commenting on current events.
All right, so
no, I don't know. You got me.
Okay, well, let me give you a hint. the three is a kind of a decoy here because before the movie was made, one of the three dropped out of the act, and it was just two comics. Does that help you at all?
No, I gotta say it doesn't.
No? It's Bill and Ted.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that technically is a high school movie.
Well, I mean, yeah, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is all about high school, right? It's not a John Hughes thing.
It's
all about doing
a high
school.
It's all about time travel, actually. I mean, they don't really spend any time in high school. Okay, well, that makes sense.
It was a bit underhanded of me to ask it that way. But anyway, yeah, Bill and Ted came from this stand-up act, and originally it was Bill, Ted, and Bob. The guy who played Bob lost interest and dropped out, so then it was just Bill and Ted. And it wasn't the actors in the movie. The original people to create these characters were Chris Matheson and Ed Solomon, and they were part of an improv comedy act, and basically they got a movie made out of those characters.
Well, that wraps things up for this week, but of course what doesn't get wrapped up is the website at allmovietalk.com. We have a regularly updated weblog with all sorts of entries, both relating to the show and just other general things about movies. So be sure to hop over to allmovietalk.com if you haven't. Set up an account and feel free to let us know what you think about this or anything else that happens to be on your head if it relates to film.
And tune in next week, of course, for episode 36. We got some great stuff coming. We got a how-to segment. That seems to be a favorite amongst listeners, and we're going to tell you all about what to do when things get weird. And we'll also do the second half of the Disney Animated Features Spotlight. Our top six list, movies with a strong sense of place. Get your brain working, think about ones that have a strong sense of place for you, and see if we come up with it next week, and if not, maybe post to our website about what we missed.
Le coupé!